Tucker is next.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Is John Sims, who's going to talk to us about being a disaster chaplain. What exactly is that, John?
Well, Steve, a disaster chaplain is defined by our Department of Homeland Security now, is a chaplain who has been trained to respond to a disaster crisis anywhere in the country.
Now, were there such things as disaster chaplains before there was a Department of Homeland Security?
Oh, yeah. Many of us remember Transworld Airlines Flight 800, Lockerbie, Scotland, Pan Am 103, Alaska Airlines 261 in the Pacific. In 1996, the National Transportation Safety Board established with the American Red Cross a new division called Spiritual Care and Aviation Incident Response. The acronym would be SCARE, but that was felt to be a little over the top, so it was changed to SAIR, Spiritual Care in Aviation Incident Response.
And what is spiritual care? I mean, you're a Methodist minister. Do you try to convert people to being Protestant Christians?
No, not at all. Spiritual care as defined by Department of Homeland Security, the American Red Cross, the NTSB, is helping each individual in the midst of or shortly after a crisis of huge proportions to find their relationship with the divine as they understand that sense of the divine. So when I was on the viewing platform at Ground Zero, 12 days after the World Trade Center's collapsed, people who were Buddhist, who were animist, who were Muslim, who were Catholic, who were Jewish, my job was not to tell them about my expression of faith, but listen to them and what they understood and interpreted as their response to the divine.
Now, what motivated you to get involved in this to start with? I mean, who would want to be close to people who are in such pain?
It was due to the death of my son. My son Adam was a student at U of I.
Oh, really?
And was killed very tragically in January of 1998. I was so deep in grief with my wife Sharon and daughter Emily that first year that I was trying to find ways to make sense of that. Not why did that tragedy happen, but what does God wish me to do now? So as a member of the police, I was teaching at the U of I and the Police Training Institute at the time. I submitted an application through the International Conference of Police Chaplains for this new training that NTSB was starting for spiritual care. Was accepted by NTSB and went for training to learn how to respond when people are that deep in hurt. And I simply did it as a way to make sense of my own son's tragedy.
Now, when you say you were trained, you'd already been to seminary. You'd already had a college degree. I think you told me it was in communication. So you knew how to speak to people and how to listen and things like that. What additional training did you get to help you in those kind of settings?
A spiritual care chaplain was initially developed by NTSB to help victims, victims' families after an airline crash. And being perfectly blunt about it, in an airline crash, all one receives back is pieces. We do not get bodies back. So to help people deal with not being able to see and touch their loved one, to help people deal with maybe getting a bone, maybe getting a DNA sample, maybe getting some dirt from the spot where their plane went down. It was a way to try and help people deal with finding the answers out of their own personal faith expression.
Now, when you say answers, do you mean answers as to you know, the ultimate questions. Why do these things happen? Why is there death? Why is there disaster? Why me? Or, again, what you were saying earlier about you, how do you get on from here? What do you do next?
Let me tell you a story. When I was the first chaplain to be allowed by the Federal Emergency Management Agency and the NTSB to go over to the Ground Zero site, and I'm a city boy. I grew up near St. Louis in Belleville, Illinois. So when somebody would say the Ground Zero site was 16 acres in size, I couldn't make sense of that. Mm-hmm. But once I was informed it was 4 square city blocks, mm-hmm. 16 city blocks, mm-hmm. I could visualize that. I was standing on the viewing platform with victims' families. And when I was there, it was still smoking. There was still dust in the air. We were all in hard hats and dust masks. The city of New York was driving a water truck filled with chlorine all around the site to keep down the odor. Hmm. I was standing with a family whose husband and father was one of the first firefighters in. He was from Brooklyn, from a Brooklyn station. Hmm. His wife and his two daughters were there, 16 and 14. The 14-year-old turned to me and started hammering on my chest and said, "Why? Mm-hmm. Why did this happen?"
Sure.
And I looked at her, and in the midst of my own absolute incomprehension with the sight, and with her question, I looked at her and said, "I don't know." Mm-hmm. I said, "Let's talk when we get back to the Family Assistance Center." Mm-hmm. And she just kept pounding on me. Mm-hmm. When we got back later that afternoon to the Family Assistance Center, I sat with the family for hours, just listening to them talk about their father and her husband. And after hours of just being there, the 14-year-old, Rebecca is her name, she looked at me and she said, "You know, Chaplain, you'd make a good rabbi." Now, here I am mm-hmm. in a clergy collar, in a green vest that has NTSB chaplain on it. Mm-hmm. And I looked at this little teenager and I said, "You know, I don't think I qualify."
But you obviously touched her and reached her.
She mm-hmm. touched me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We're talking on Keeping the Faith this afternoon with John Sims, who is a disaster chaplain, about some of his experiences. He is a Methodist minister and pastor of the First Methodist Church of Urbana. And that's just been since January, right, John?
Just since January.
And before that, you were in St. Joe.
I was in St. Joseph.
Nearby.
Right, 8 miles away.
And how long had you been at the Methodist Church in St. Joe?
I was in St. Joseph, my wife and I, for 6.5 years.
6.5 years. Before that?
I was in a church in Edwardsville, Illinois.
Because Methodist pastors move fairly regularly, right?
Well, that's typical. Average length of stay is about 5 years uh-huh. in this annual conference.
Uh-huh. And where before that?
From Edwardsville, I was at Alton, Illinois for 8 years.
Okay. Where'd you go to seminary?
Went to seminary out in Kansas City, Missouri, mm-hmm. St. Paul School of Theology.
College?
SIU Carbondale. Go Salukis.
Let listeners know that if you have a comment or question about anything that John and I are talking about today, please feel free to call. There's a toll-free number for any where this program is heard, 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL, the call letters of the station, of course. Listeners in Champaign-Urbana may punch in 333-9455 in their phones and reach several local lines. That's 333-WILL in the Champaign-Urbana listening area. Getting back to our guest today, John Sims, When you received some special training recently at Pine Bluff, Arkansas, what was that all about?
I have been certified through the NTSB as a disaster chaplain for spiritual care and aviation incident response. With the new development of Department of Homeland Security, it was felt that all SAIR chaplains should be upgraded and recertified to become spiritual response team members. So I went to Pine Bluff at the request of Homeland Security and the National Red Cross Office to be recertified as a spiritual care chaplain, and also to be certified as a crisis response team member.
Hmm. And how many folks are there like that?
In the U.S. right now, there are 160 spiritual care chaplains.
Hmm.
And across the U.S., I suspect there are probably 400 or 500 CRT certified people.
Mm-hmm. Now, are you paid?
No.
So you are volunteers and able to do this because the people who are paying you think it's appropriate.
I think it's wonderful that my church supports me like they do.
And tell us how that works. If you're suddenly called, what about if you have a funeral at the church that week? Or how do you decide what to do?
Oh, Steve, my first on-call assignment was in the month of September 2001.
Hmm.
I was on call on 9/11.
Hmm.
The NTSB and now the Department of Homeland Security sends the little yellow box, we call it, which contains a cell phone, a pager, special telephone numbers to Red Cross and NTSB and Homeland Security offices. In September of 2001, it was a beautiful day.
Mm-hmm.
On Tuesday, September the 11th, I was sitting in a clergy meeting at the original Pancake House on Madison Springfield. And at 8:46, the first plane went in.
Mm-hmm.
At 8:47, my NTSB pager went off.
Mm-hmm.
We all thought it was an airline crash.
Of course.
An errant pilot who simply got lost. I was told to call this unlisted number, which I did, and was told to hop on a plane from Willard Airport immediately. Well, a minute later, I was called back and said, everything's been grounded.
Yeah.
Try to get to Scott Air Force Base and hop a military fighter out.
Where is that? Where is Scott Air Force Base?
Down near Belleville,
oh.
4 hours away.
Oh.
Well, that was immediately canceled.
Uh-huh.
I was also told to take a train from Chicago, and that was canceled. So I waited. Mm-hmm. I got to Ground Zero. I got to my family assistance center where I was assigned approximately 10 days to 2 weeks after Ground Zero, after the planes went in.
Hmm. Now, what arrangement do you have with your congregation? They know that you're going to need to respond if called upon.
Yes.
Who fills in for you?
Strange you should ask that, Steve. I was on call last month in the month of May.
Uh-huh.
I completed my recertification training late in April, and in May I was told that should the pager go off, I would have to be en route within 4 hours. So I had a suitcase packed.
Uh-huh.
Everything was ready to go. I made arrangements for people to preach for me. I had a number of weddings in May.
Sure.
I had to find people to fill in should I be there.
A campus church.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I just frankly worried about it the entire month.
Of course.
And on May the 12th, my pager went off. And I literally jumped, and called in on the special number and was told this was nothing more than a test.
I see. Huh.
And I found that after that initial shock and just incomprehension, the rest of the month went okay.
Mm.
Because I'd already heard the ring.
Mm-hmm.
I know what it sounded like.
Mm-hmm.
I knew what I was going to do.
Mm.
It's just stressful being on call.
Huh. And so if the pager goes off during the next, say, 45 minutes of this program, I just need to ad lib.
I'm out of here.
Well, we'll see what happens. Let me repeat our phone numbers for our listeners. If you'd like to call with a question for our guest, John Sims, who is pastor of the First Methodist Church of Urbana and a disaster chaplain in Champaign, Urbana, the number is 333-9455. Elsewhere, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. And that number, incidentally, is good for people who are listening on the Internet. This program can be accessed via computer with 3w.will.uiuc.edu and then going to AM 580. So, tell us, what was your first experience like or you felt you didn't know how to respond to people?
in 2001, I was a member of a 5-person chaplain's team who would respond on call during that month should there be an airline crash. Mm-hmm. Initially, we all thought the World Trade Center was an airline crash. Mm-hmm. After it was determined that this was a terrorist act, when I went, I followed a dear friend and mentor of mine, in fact, a resident of Champaign, Dr. Don Houts.
Oh, sure.
Personal friend of mm-hmm. mine. I followed Don at a place called Liberty Island State Park, which is in Jersey City, New Jersey, just across the Hudson River from the Ground Zero site. And when I got there, I expected to see 4 of my closest friends there with me, and nobody else was there. Mm. I was there for 11 days and was the only chaplain, the only SAIR-trained chaplain at the site. Mm. And was overwhelmed by it. Was over 15 to 20-hour days, just simply trying to listen to people. Mm.
So what spiritual resources of your own do you call on in times like that when you're exhausted and people from many different religious backgrounds or none are talking with you? What gets you through it?
What got me through it and what gets me through it, Steve, is this. This is not about me. This is not about me being the star or the chaplain in charge. I have difficulties with being other than anything but a helper in this circumstance. Mm-hmm. My job is to help people get in touch with how they conceive of the divine, how they understand their relationship with their God in their times of crisis. For me to say to a Buddhist or a Muslim or a Jewish person or a Roman Catholic priest on the viewing platform at Ground Zero, well, this is the way you must feel, mm-hmm. would be the height of arrogance. Mm-hmm. And I will not do it.
Mm-hmm. And you said that when you first got into this, you did it to deal with your own needing to get on with life and to do something helpful at a time when you were suffering because of the death of your son. Have you found that this has been healing for you, or has it just kept those wounds open?
It has been healing for me. Hmm. It has been healing for me, especially when Rebecca started banging on my chest, saying why. That's not the question. Hmm. The question is, what does God have in mind now? Hmm. I would not have been involved with spiritual care through NTSB or Homeland Security now if it had not been for my son Adam's death. Mm-hmm. I would have found no reason to try and be a part of that.
Hmm. When these kind of tragedies happen, there have been studies that show that people are in shock. And does that happen to you too, as someone who's trying to help? I mean, it's just as much a surprise to you. You may not have family involved, but as you say, your pager's gone off and suddenly you're there. Mm-hmm. And how do you deal with shock?
Let me tell you how I did it at the Family Assistance Center where mm-hmm. I was stationed. I was there for 11 to 12 days, depends on how you count them. The last 2 or 3, people were coming up to me and saying, "Chaplain, you look awful." Mm-hmm. I wasn't eating well. Mm. I wasn't drinking enough, I wasn't sleeping enough, and I found that I was beginning to be unhelpful because I was not providing what people needed. They were looking at me and saying, "Gosh, you look awful."
Yeah.
and that's when I went to a disaster mental health person at the Family Assistance
Center. And they said, "You need to sleep." Yeah.
Actually, she said, "Gosh, you look awful."
Yeah.
And I said, "I think I need to talk to somebody about this."
Yeah.
And she said, "Well, what was it like at Ground Zero?" Mm-hmm. And I said, "It wasn't like anything I can describe." Mm-hmm. And she said, "Well, so you're telling me that because I haven't had that experience, I can't know what you're feeling." And I said, "Yeah, that's what I'm saying." Mm-hmm. So she said, "Are you suggesting that I should go over to Ground Zero in my official capacity and see what it's like?" And I said, That's up to you, Diana. But in order for us to have a commonality here, people have asked me when I came back in October of 2001, what was it like? And Steve, what I remember the most was standing on the viewing platform, being completely surrounded by nothing but gray, a monochromatic landscape of nothing but gray and particles of gray and dust in the air, and seeing 20-story cranes that looked like Tonka toys out there on the rubble. I remember seeing a Caterpillar tractor with the huge claw front digging in what were the remains of the North Tower, and all of a sudden hitting a pocket of explosive gases. And we all heard this whoomp, and all of a sudden gas and flame shot up at least 40 stories, 400 feet in the air. And I remember saying, dear God, it's still bleeding. It's still bleeding. When the disaster mental health professional came back, she had that thousand-yard stare, which Vietnam veterans and World War II veterans and all veterans can understand. And she said, I think I understand now. And I said, this is not something that gives us any kind of specialness. This is something with which we have to come to grips with. And when I came back to Willard Airport in the middle of October, I drive a beautiful convertible, little red convertible, and my wife Sharon picked me up, and we were driving back to St. Joseph. We got right out about 4 miles out of Urbana next to Mayview. One of the farmers had a pile of limestone rock ready to spread on his field, which was the same color as Ground Zero. And I immediately flashed back to it.
Sure.
And I remember my wife Sharon saying, hey, where are you? Where are you? And that's when I said, I need to talk to a professional about this. So I went for psychotherapy. I went for counseling just to be sure I was dealing with it right.
Sure.
And there are still times when I don't want to think about it.
Now, Henry Nouwen had a book called The Wounded Healer that talks about how if you're going to be able to be helpful to anybody who themselves are going through trauma and pain, the person who's helpful best is someone who's has at least suffered and is in a way conscious about it. Does that ring true to you?
Yes. Yes. I find I am a better pastor because of my son's death. I find I'm a better pastor at Urbana First Church because of Ground Zero in some strange, mysterious way.
Now, as a pastor, you have balance when you deal with people in pain who've had a death in the family, who are suffering or seeing someone they love in pain and suffering from accident or illness. You have a balance because you're also doing baptisms, because you're also performing at wedding ceremonies where people are looking to the future, where there's joy and happiness. If you do too much of this disaster chaplain stuff, doesn't it just ruin you?
It throws off the balance.
So you have to find a red convertible, I guess, somewhere.
Yeah. Well, yesterday, for example, in the morning I officiated at the funeral of a very, very respected woman, a teacher of German, Kate Wilbur. That afternoon, I officiated at a wedding at Lake of the Woods. Seeing both sides of it was balanced.
We're talking on Keeping the Faith this afternoon with John Sims, who is pastor of the First Methodist Church in Urbana, Illinois, which is located on the corner of what, Green Street and Race Street?
Green and Race.
Green and Race, right at Lincoln Square Shopping Center, where there's plenty of parking, and where you have worship services at what time?
8 o'clock and 10:30.
8 o'clock and 10:30 on Sunday morning. He has also been a disaster chaplain, and we're talking about some of his experiences at that. We do encourage folks to call in with questions or comments. We'll be getting back to John in just a moment or two. If you'd like to jot down this phone number, 333-9455 for listeners in the Champaign-Urbana listening area. Those of you who are listening from farther away may call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL, the call letters of our station. You're listening to AM 580, WILL. These Keeping the Faith programs come every Sunday afternoon from 5 to 6 p.m., Central Daylight Time these days. Listeners to this program may appreciate another couple programs coming up this week on WILL. On the Afternoon Magazine this week on Wednesday, the 9th of June, a little after 1 o'clock, Celeste Quinn will be talking with a guest who is a professor from the University of Delaware, Joan Del Fattori, about the fourth R, conflicts over religion in America's public schools. That's on the Afternoon Magazine this Wednesday on WILL at a little after 1 o'clock with Celeste Quinn. And on Thursday this week on WILL on Focus 580 with David Inge at 10 o'clock on the 10th of June, David Inge's guest will be Dharmad McCulloch, who is a professor of history at Oxford University in England, about the Reformation. That'll be this Thursday, 10 o'clock on Focus 580. Support for these Keeping the Faith programs is provided in part by the University YMCA, where I'm the executive director. My name is Steve Shoemaker. The Y is the oldest religious institution at the university. It was started by students in 1873. It's the oldest continuous student organization on this campus, and since that time has been providing opportunities for social action and community service and leadership development opportunities for university students. We also have programs for faculty and staff and people in the community. This is the kind of Y, however, that does not have a gym or a pool or a fitness center, just a grand old building on Wright Street and some wonderful programs. One of our programs is Communiversity. These are non-credit courses that encourage people to be lifelong learners. Perhaps college students would like to take a course outside of their major that's non-credit, but also no exams. We have all sorts of courses, everything from social dance, clogging, Chicago steppin', beginning swing. We have courses in exercise and body work, yoga, Tai Bo, Pilates, I think it's pronounced, all kinds of massage classes. You can learn how to give your friends a foot massage or a back massage or arm and hand massage, courses in the martial arts, karate for kids, Aikido, Taekwondo. We have courses in photography taught by Clark Brooks, who's been a longtime teacher at the Y. Excellent teacher in photography. Classes in summer wildflowers. If you'd like to learn more about wildflowers, you can sign up for a course taught by some wonderful Y students who know all about botany. If you'd like to learn more about these classes, pick up a calendar at the Y or around town. You can also check out a catalog online at universityymca.org and then look at Communiversity. Registration begins this week. Most of the classes start, I think it's the week of the 21st of June, although some classes start a little earlier and some later. Very inexpensive and a chance to do something fun this summer, learn something new. Also at the Y this week, we are still collecting for our grand dump and run recycling program where things that you may be tired of in your home, furniture, kitchen things, yard things, if you donate them to the Y, we will save them till the fall when students come back, and particularly international students. Over 4,000 on this campus come in often with nothing except a couple suitcases and need to furnish a dorm room or apartment. So please feel free to donate. We're open to accept those things from 9 to 4 this week. And then again, the next Saturday we'll be open will be July 10 from 9 to 4. So this week, Monday through Friday, 9 to 4, we're accepting donations for our grand yard sale in the fall. And the dates for that, incidentally, it'll be at the Stock Pavilion at the University this year because it's outgrown our Y building at 1001 South Wright. But the Stock Pavilion at the University on Pennsylvania Avenue, August 26, 27, and 28 will be our grand sale for Dump and Run. It's about 5:30, and I'd like to do something I haven't done for a while on this program, but that's to give our guest, John Sims in this case, a little chance to catch his breath and have a drink of water before we finish the program. And I'm going to read a poem that's in a recently published book by Jean Murray Walker. Her book is titled A Deed to the Light. It's a publication of the University of Illinois Press. It's one of the books in the Illinois Poetry Series, edited by Lawrence Lieberman. I'd like to read her poem, Light, which was first published in Poetry Magazine in Chicago. This is, of course, read with the permission of the owner of the copyright, the poet Jean Murray Walker. That's W-A-L-K-E-R. Professor Walker is a professor of English at the University of Delaware, and her poems have appeared in many publications. She's the author of several books and has won several awards. Here's a poem called Light. And then there was Mr. Luman, the teacher whose death they announced that Tuesday, who vowed to donate $10,000 to the one of us who named our first kid, Igor Stravinsky. Just send him a telegram to let him know, he said. He'd cut off his thumbs for culture. He'd be happy to dive 5 stories naked from the window to make us understand to be or not to be. He knew we thought he had no real life, that he was a cardboard cutout they wheeled from the closet every morning. And really, what was he but the longing to instill in us the finer things? He was nothing but echoes that lingered after the last note of Beethoven's 5th. He dodged through subjects like a bumper car. He had to teach us everything. He begged the boys not to wear hats to class, to see the Nutcracker. That final day, when the bell rang, he was still talking about Queen Elizabeth, how Lord Burleigh brought a 10-pound note to the coronation to buy back the British crown from God, who is the true king. I unfolded my bright limbs and filed past him to math. The last thing I heard him say before he met the train at the blind crossing was how he loved Hamlet, how he wanted to be Hamlet, the one character who knew enough to write the play he's in. The poem Light by Jean Murray Walker from her new book from Illinois Press, A Deed to the Light. Well, with that respite from disasters, let's get back to our topic. We go from a memory of a fine teacher to the experiences of a pastor who has voluntarily decided to put himself, if not in harm's way, at least in a quick response when there's been harm. John, you told us earlier in the program that the reason what motivated you to do this was the death of your own son when he was in college here at the University of Illinois. And you went into this kind of work as a volunteer with the permission and encouragement from your church. At that time, you were in St. Joe,
right,
as a Methodist pastor. When you go through something personal like that, nothing is worse, of course, than losing one's own child. Did you feel angry at God? Did you feel disappointed that somehow, in spite of your dedication to the church and your belief and your faith, that something like this happened to your family?
Honestly, Steve, I didn't. My wife Sharon and I and our daughter Emily and her husband Tim, I don't think any of us felt this way. It was never a question why. It was a chaotic accident. And the question for me was not, why God? The question was, what do I do now? What would you have me do with this? One of the funniest things that happened to me was at the visitation for my son. A very good friend of my wife's came through, And she leaned up to me and she said, "We are so sorry. You'll see him again." Mm-hmm. And I said, "You're right, Ruby, but I want to see him now."
Sure.
And she said, she looked kind of surprised, yeah. And she said, "But you'll see him again." Mm-hmm. And I said, "Yes, but I want to see him now." Mm-hmm. With that, she leaned up to me, gave me a hug, a peck on the cheek, and said, "You'll see him again," and got out before I could see anything else.
Of course.
There were experiences like that at New York after coming back from Ground Zero. The American Red Cross, I think, purchased every teddy bear on the East Coast prior to allowing victims' families to come to the actual Ground Zero site. They were all kept in a huge brown dumpster. So as victims' families came through the area to the actual Ground Zero viewing platform, I handed out teddy bears to everybody who would take them. Mm-hmm. And of course, being clergy, I really didn't think I needed one, so I didn't pick one up. After coming off the viewing platform, the most moving thing I have ever experienced in my life, Steve, was being with a group of victims' families, and as we came down off of that viewing platform, every worker there, every trooper, New York and New Jersey, every firefighter, lined the road and stood at attention, took off their helmets, and placed their hands over their heart. I have never, ever felt anything that moving. That's when I picked up a teddy bear on the way back. When we got back with the victims' families at that very first time there, probably 50 to 55 people, some people immediately headed for the cafeteria and would mound up plates of food. Some people immediately let down and laid down on couches and slept. Other people sought out the companionship of dogs. The National Organization for Victims Assistance brought care dogs, huge, friendly golden retrievers and black labs. And these dogs wanted nothing to be petted. And people would just sob on these dogs. Me, I decided to see if I could eat everything in New Jersey.
Comfort food.
Comfort food. I didn't care what it was. I really thought I might even eat the styrofoam. I was so famished. The American Red Cross rented a car for me, a beautifully brand new 2001 Dodge Intrepid, a beautiful light bronze
fast
Ford.
Car.
Oh, well, it didn't have to be fast. It had it was in New Jersey. It had New York State license plates on it, but the entire right rear quarter panel was caved in from an accident.
I see.
When I would get on the New Jersey Turnpike going north 25 miles to where my motel room was in Secaucus, New Jersey, the hog butchering capital of the Northeast, I would go by these New Jersey drivers. They would see this guy driving this beautifully new car with New York plates on it with the whole right rear side caved in. They just got out of my way.
I see.
It was wonderful. It really was.
Figured that car had been close to the World Trade Center.
They got out of my way quick.
My wife and I had a friend who was on the first plane that crashed into the Trade Centers, and we got an email from his mother, who we'd known for years and seen this young boy grow up. And in fact, I'd performed his wedding a few years prior. When she found out that her son had been killed, she, of course, was devastated, but felt she needed to tell her friends and people who knew her son. And when we went to the memorial service for him in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, at a Unitarian church, she and her husband were able to speak and expressed concern for the parents of the terrorists who'd been on the plane, planes that had crashed them, because she knew those parents had also had a loss. And it was just an amazing act of sympathy and understanding and grace. I don't think I could have done anything like that at all, but it was very heartfelt and very very moving. And of course, there are stories like that in from many places of people who see beyond their own grief, their own loss, and realize that others have had that same thing in very different circumstances. We're talking with John Sims, who is a disaster chaplain and responds to disasters, particularly in the airline industry, but now also through the Department of Homeland Security for these kind of incidents. If you have a question or a comment, please do give us a phone call. 333-9455 is the local number in Champaign-Urbana. 1-800-222-9455 is a toll-free number that listeners may use outside of this listening area. Let's talk a little bit about Scripture. You're a Protestant pastor, a Methodist. You're trained in Bible study. Is the Bible a resource for you when you deal with people who are suffering from loss? Are the Psalms helpful, or are any parts of the Scripture helpful?
When I was at Ground Zero, Steve, we have, among the 160 of us chaplains who are trained in this, we have what we call our go box. Mm-hmm. It includes Islamic scriptures, the Quran. It includes a Roman Catholic Bible. Mm-hmm. It includes Buddhist material. It includes as many different kinds of religious traditions as we can locate.
So would each chaplain have access to this? Is that the idea?
Each on-call chaplain every month would have access to the go box.
Okay.
The go box will go with us no matter where we are, no matter what we respond to.
So you not only have the resources of your own religious tradition, you have others to be helpful to the folks like that.
Absolutely.
Let me go quickly to a phone call, and then we'll get back to that if we can. We'll go to line one. You're on Keeping the Faith with our guest, John Sims.
Just a comment. When I was an undergraduate at the university, I took a class at McKinley from Reverend Dick Watts, and one of the books he recommended to us was Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, which deeply touched me. The message was that we always have control of our attitude about a particular situation, and it must take a great deal of time to come to that when you go through the shock of something like 9/11. But it also focuses on the meaning in our life and the meaning of suffering, and I think that would be, for some people at some point, that might be a good message or a good thing to think about or read.
Thank you very much for the suggestion. Appreciate it.
I think she's absolutely right. I think you are, caller. I've read the book. I feel the same way. As we search for meaning each in our own way, spiritual care involves being sensitive to that which is important to you as you relate to your conception of the divine. My job as a disaster chaplain is not to go into places where everything is in a chaotic mess and say, I'm here. It's to help people as they deal with it. My recent training at Pine Bluff, Arkansas, the third week of April, dealt with this understanding of crisis response team ministry. There are 24 highly trained people each month who are on call to be the first responders through the Department of Homeland Security should there be a disaster anywhere in the country. The 24 of us, for example, in the month of May, each had our own particular area of competence. And because we have been trained together as a team of 24, I knew where other people's areas of competence were and could feel absolutely comfortable with knowing that they would do their job and that they expected me and experienced me to be able to do my job.
When you go out in with a group, does the Department of Homeland Security try to have balance on teams so that there are Protestants and Catholics and Jews and others?
You know, Steve, I can't answer that specifically, but my understanding and my relationship with other spiritual response team members is this is not an issue. We are not here to trumpet our own particular expression of faith. We are there to help other people. And if a Muslim needs support and encouragement of the Quran, I know the verses in the Quran. And if a Roman Catholic brother or sister needs the comfort of a rosary, I know where I can get a rosary. And if a Jewish brother or sister needs the comfort of the Psalms, I know where the Psalms are.
The Psalms are an interesting example. In the church I attended this morning, since I'm not pastoring a congregation right now, but I'm a director of an ecumenical ministry at the Y, I get the opportunity to go around and appreciate other services. And then where I was this morning, there was a psalm read responsively, and it was one of these psalms of confidence. You know, if God is with you, I forget which number it was, but God is with you and your foot won't stumble and, you know, and you won't fall. And I kept thinking, boy, I'm sure glad there are other psalms in the Bible that talk about what happens and how you feel and that God is there even when you are falling and when you feel God's abandoned you and when, like Psalm 22. But the psalms are the collection of poetry about so many, expressing so many different emotions, of confidence that you're not going to get hurt. But then when you're hurt, how you feel then?
Yeah, one of the experiences I remember at the Family Assistance Center at Liberty Island State Park, FEMA and all New Jersey agencies set up mobile trailers in a horseshoe shape around this Family Assistance Center so that victims' family members could go and start the process which is needed for this kind of completion. The most difficult thing I saw people face at the Family Assistance Center was trying to apply for a death certificate. Because to apply for a death certificate means that you've given up hope.
Right.
And nothing happens in this country without legal documentation.
Sure.
And I saw uncounted people who would simply freeze on the steps of this first trailer because to say, I'm applying for the death certificate for my loved one who was killed at the World Trade Center is in effect to say there's no hope.
Right.
I stood with people who kept saying, I can't go in. To which I replied, then let's not go in yet. Other people said, let's just get this over with.
Since death is a subject that particularly Americans, I think, maybe Western Europeans as well, try to avoid and usually successfully, I'm guessing that there are radios that have been turned off a lot during this last hour as we've talked about it. But for those still listening who have the courage to face an ultimate part of life, what's your attitude towards death as a disaster chaplain?
One of the chaplaincy dimensions which I've picked up recently is I am privileged to be chaplain for local 1260 Champaign firefighters in the City of Champaign Fire Department. And I do this again without pay because it's not about pay. It's about supporting firefighters in the Champaign area who go to such disasters as the recent hanging in Southwest Champaign late last week, or go to a fire realizing that they are laying their lives on the line. Something could happen which could go strangely and mysteriously wrong all of a sudden. My job is simply to be there. 80% of what I do, Steve, is just be there.
And what does your presence offer?
I hope the Champaign Fire Department firefighters, for example, know that just my being there says somebody cares about you. And if you're injured, I'll be there. And if, as one firefighter has done, he's over in Iraq right now, I write to him. And God forbid something should happen, I'll be there with them, you know, at the hospital. And I even go out and watch them cook lunch.
And does your Christian faith that talks a lot about life beyond death, hope for eternal life even? Does that enter into your own, not that you're forcing that on that understanding or that belief on anybody else, but does that affect how you can deal with people who are facing death?
Yes. Yes, it does. Remember when I told you that 14-year-old Rebecca starts shouting and yelling and screaming, why? And I said, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
After we talked, the question for her was, why did my dad die?
Mm-hmm.
Why did God take my dad? We simply talked together, she and I. I talked with her family. They told me about how he understood the fire service as a way of giving himself to the community.
Hmm.
I'm going to be there even if it puts my life on the line.
Hmm.
And when she realized that, I think she began to see her dad was a hero.
We have another caller waiting, again on a local line, line number one. You're on Keeping the Faith with our guest John Sims. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I'm a member of the church where John is our minister. And I just wanted to mention that before he came to our church, I had occasion to be on a trip where he was, and somebody on the trip got ill and fainted, and John came out of the group and came up to this person and said, Alice, I will be with you. And the most kind, wonderful voice that I didn't even know for sure that he was a minister at that time, but you could just, he just had this way of relating to her in a very minor, it was not a serious situation, but his saying that just being there and letting people know that he would stay with them, I think, is a very, very strong part of what he does. So I just wanted to share that.
Well, thank you very much for sharing that. Since this is radio, our listeners can't see John blushing, but I'll report it. where did you... How'd you get interested in being a minister in the first place?
Actually, I'm a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
I've always defined myself as a teacher. I held for many years a teaching certification from the state of Illinois. My field's speech and debate. I was a debater all through junior high, high school, and college, and really thought I wanted to be I did want to be a teacher.
Uh-huh.
Very quickly, the Vietnam War and the draft in 1969 made that impossible for me.
Hmm.
And I decided that to respond to God's call was more important to do than what I wanted to do.
Hmm. So we have a caller waiting. I'll get to that in just a minute. But just to finish that up a bit, so you were drafted during Vietnam days. Did you go in the Army?
Yes, I did.
And what did you do?
I was a chaplain's assistant in a leg unit.
The 25th Infantry Division.
No, are you kidding? No, I was a chaplain's. I chose being a chaplain's assistant. Was given the position.
Hmm.
Was overseas in Honolulu, Hawaii.
Hmm.
I was in Honolulu on Waikiki Beach for 13 months.
Hmm.
It was tough duty.
We'll get back to that if we have time. Let's get to another caller who is on our toll-free line, line 4. You're on Keeping the Faith. Go ahead, please.
Hello. Thank you for a very important program. Some observations, and I congratulate Mr. Sims on his work. It seems to me that... terrible disasters often bring out the very, very best in people. They help one another when they can, and it crosses ethnic and racial and gender lines and so forth. The potential is there to feel for other people once you've suffered terribly, and it seems to me that if there were a way to build on that, to recognize that, and after we've cleared through the grief and the disaster, if one ever does, to feel for others and ultimately prevent the kind of hatreds and animosities and so forth that a lot of pressures in ordinary life are leading us toward, that keep us separated. These are the times that bring us together, and where we could help one another, the world is surely richer.
Thank you for that comment. Has that been your experience, John, that these kind of tragedies do bring people together, make them better somehow?
I saw people hold one another on the viewing platform at Ground Zero just because they cared,
mm-hmm.
just because they wanted to help.
Mm-hmm.
My job is not to be the star. My job is to be the helper. My job is to be the one who, God forbid, should there be another terrorist activity or disaster, man-made or natural, in this country, I just want to do my part. Mm-hmm. Not because it makes me look good, because frankly, in another 10 years, who's going to care? But if someone's life can be touched because of how I feel in my expression of the faith, that's what I want to do.
Now, as a bit of a cynic in these matters, don't disasters also give people the opportunity to take advantage of other people, to steal things, to do bits of nastiness? I mean, it's certainly not all people responding positively to others in need. Some people seem to take advantage of folks, particularly when they're most vulnerable.
Sure. Sure. I'm realistic enough to realize this, but I know what I'm going to do, and I know why I'm going to do it.
So for you, it's a matter of choice?
Matter of choice.
And the choice is made in your case because of what?
Because of my faith, because of what happened to my kid, because of the support I have from my wife and my daughter. I do what I do out of a faith stance.
And you have a congregation of co-religionists who support you in this.
I have a wonderful congregation who supports me in this.
Yeah.
And they don't have to.
Sure.
But they do.
Sure.
And I'm very appreciative.
So they're giving some hard-earned money to help you do this, actually.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, we've run out of time on our Keeping the Faith program today with our guest, John Sims, who is the pastor at the First Methodist Church in Urbana on the corner of Race and Green Street. John, tell us again the times of your worship services.
Service at 8 o'clock and the main service at 10:30.
On Sundays. We've been talking about his experience as a disaster chaplain offering spiritual care through now the Department of Homeland Security in times of national tragedies. We thank our callers for making their comments and asking their questions, and of course thank our guest for sharing so personally with us today here on Keeping the Faith. Next week, our guest on Keeping the Faith will be Eric Anglada from the Catholic Worker House. Eric is one of these folks who's chosen voluntary poverty because of his religious beliefs. We'll be talking with Eric about that on Keeping the Faith next Sunday at 5 o'clock. And the following week, we'll be talking with Jeff Trask, who is a minister at New Covenant Christian Fellowship, about the Champaign County Christian Health Center that's being formed in this county. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for this program, Keeping the Faith. I want to thank all of our listeners for participating so actively over the years, calling and asking questions. And thank everyone else for listening.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
He's been called the godfather of hip-hop. He rose from selling drugs on the streets to running a Fortune 500 company. He founded Def Jam Records and produced acts like Run DMC, Public Enemy, and LL Cool J. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge, Russell Simmons and hip-hop. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 here on WILL Urbana.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: EAGCO Incorporated, Fairmont; Thrifty Nickel, Champaign; and GCOM Incorporated in Savoy. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, mostly clear with a low in the mid-60s and southeast winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly sunny in the morning, then becoming partly sunny, the high in the mid-80s with south winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a low in the upper 60s and south winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. You're listening to WILL Urbana, made possible by the support of our listeners, the friends of WILL. It's 6 p.m. Central Time. This American Life is next.